ABBA. And what's interesting is that Dimmy Mint ABBA is the stepmum of Noura Mint Somali that played at Counterflaws. And I really wanted to play a bit of that because that was a tape. One of the, it's a, just a nice example of a tape that Gert made me in 1991 or 92. That I listened to death, and then like I said, then it comes around again, and it's sort of like connects to Counterflows and stuff. Started getting into improvising.
They did
the first record they did from the BIM house, the jazz place in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
I think it was 1991, I think.
Oh, okay.
And it's another loop around because there's a track, I'd love to play a track off of that. And some of the players that are on there were playing in the ICP. I mean, Han Benink, of course, was involved, and Walter Weirboss, people like that. And again, it's a nice loop around because years later, ICP came and played with the Glasgow Improvisers Orchestra. Mm-hmm. After seeing Han Benink play in the X and in other configurations in the ICP, I actually got to kind of share a stage with him and Walter Weirboss and people like that. So for all those reasons, X was just so important. A kind of door into a culture, and then the improvising and the folk culture stuff.
We'll be right back.
touched on the politics there. So, I mean, yeah. You've got the kind of DIY politics coming through the scene and various acts. And I suppose Fugazi's in the mix as well. I think GMC put on Fugazi at the art school. I know people That's talk right. about that gig.
Oh, yeah. But also, the first time Fugazi came to play, when was that? 80? Was that 90 also, I think? And
sure.
Stretchheads and Dawson both played with Fugazi at the Mayfair. Mm-hmm. The first time Fugazi came, and then Dawson played with them later at the Barras, and then yeah, after that the Music Collective put Fugazi on. But yeah, definitely the DIY culture, that's it. There was lots of different strands feeding into it.
Mm-hmm.
I think what was cool about Glasgow was that the DIY culture was aesthetically pretty diverse. Like mm-hmm. bands, like all those important bands that came a little bit after, like Long Leg and Lugworm that Jane was in originally, and actually Depp Downey from Monorail Records played in. Yummy Fur, Porno Coyote, these were all these bands that were a bit more influenced by, you know, Kleenex and maybe Fire Engines and other kind of more melodic stuff. But mm-hmm. but it wasn't that DIY was just like full-on aggressive guitars. I felt like it was quite diverse. Another really important band actually for DIY is Nyafiris.
Mm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who I think...
Yeah, they're great.
Totally amazing. Totally amazing. One-off and you know, also for that thing of not being in Glasgow, they were in Ayrshire, they were in Cumnock, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And Dogface Herons were into them, and Nyafiris played in Glasgow with the Music Collective, and they played quite a bit with the Dogface Herons. But so they were very DIY, but they never talked.
Yeah.
They never used that terminology, but they were completely, it was completely like, you know, playing in like, you know, town halls and village halls in Ayrshire. Do you mm-hmm. know what I mean? So, it doesn't get much more DIY.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that's the folk influence coming in as well with Nyafiris, but combined with this kind of literally DIY Neubauten style home junk instruments. The bladder cage was what they called it, which is just like some kind of bit of scaffolding with thing, bits of metal hanging from it that they'd bash.
Totally. And just steel barrels.
Yeah. And there's a bit where they do the toilet roll saxophone solo. Well, like free jazz through a toilet toilet roll.
Right.
On that first album. It's great. Which is like,
yeah. Brilliant. But that's true though. It's like also the folk music thing is like they had really beautiful songs as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like had the total attack and rage, but had really some really beautiful songs and hilarious songs as well, but also had some really beautiful songs.
Mm.
And talking about folk, so yeah. So all the kind of anarcho punks were really into Nyafiris, and they were also, I first heard like Dick Gawkin through Bricey and Angus, who were in Sedition, and Bricey was later in Dawson. But they grew up with their, you know, their dad's been really into folk and stuff. Bricey's dad been really into folk music. So, but that's really interesting to me that, you know, I heard Dick Gawkin from the anarcho punks. I didn't hear through the folk scene. And like you say, it's almost like Nyafiris is the great combination of those things.
Yeah. I mean, Dick Gawkin, I mean, the politics are really sound as well. And, you know, Handful of Earth, kind of classic State of the Nation folk album, really, from 1980 about deindustrialization and recognizing what was happening with Thatcher. And I suppose post 1979 devolution referendum kind of has a bearing on that record as well. So, yeah, there's so much rich content there.
Yeah. And as far as the DIY scene goes in Glasgow, those, especially the guys from Sedition and Scatha, they were also getting really into thinking about nationalism and thinking about histories and thinking about imagery trying to pick apart. You know, so there's always been so many Nazis trying to muscle in on any kind of idea of, you know, racial purity, and also in sort of in the Celtic chat. But there was people who also really believed, in the particularity of place, but trying to not get sucked into some moronic nationalism, but try and really explore particularity of place as well. And again, that was happening in the anarcho-punks as well as sort of folkies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Which, yeah.
To what extent were things like the poll tax movement involved? I mean, I know Stretchheads had a track on an anti-poll tax compilation, for example, but... I suppose once we're moving into the early 90s, and one thing that was intrigued me, I remembered Phil from Stretchheads saying, there's a Hunt saboteur group that some of the bands were connected to.
Yeah, I used to go Hunt Sabin, actually.
Oh, okay, cool.
I used to do it myself. And not, I wasn't massively involved, but I would go out a few times a year. And it's really kind of instructive for how the class system functions in the outside the city. And you would just, it was just really, really instructive that how entrenched that class stuff was. Mm-hmm. Just like, there's basically toffs that are trying to charge you down on their horses, and then they've got, you know, badly paid foot soldiers trying to crack your heads. I mean, a lot of really nasty things happened in those things. People got really beaten up really fucking badly because they would get really violent, those things. And obviously from a sort of, it is really interesting, like, that scene was this the start of so much of sort of ecological thinking, animal rights, of course, but you know, it was in the 80s the ecological stuff was moving from the hippies through to the punks, wasn't it? And it was really instructive to just to go and stand in front of a horse to protect a fox was like, just giving it that importance. In a way, you can say it's like, how do you start to, what battles do you choose to fight when there's so much oppression and there's so much environmental damage and violence and everything? But yeah, it felt really important just to fucking to try and save the life of a fox. And they're beautiful, beautiful animals. And they look all the more beautiful when they're in contrast to like people with spades trying to crack their head and literally toffs on horses trying to charge you down. So yeah, so the Hunt Saps was a big thing, and the poll tax, I wasn't massively involved, but it was very much, there's people who were really involved with organizing and going and standing in front of doors to stop bailiffs getting in. It really was. I mean, famously, I think you had, did you have Marion from Dogface Sermons with the no poll tax dress on? And
oh, right, yeah.
Publicity. Yeah. So the poll tax, it was really present. Like I say, I wasn't involved directly with it. City of Culture was another big thing, obviously. Obviously there was that great book that's got James Kelman and...
Oh, The Worker City?
Which is... And Stretchheads also have a brilliant song about it. Housewife Up Your Fucking Arse Music, I think it's called.
That's the one. Well, just to give the listeners a bit of context, 1990 was the year of culture in Glasgow. It was European City of Culture. And while there was a lot of positive stuff came out of that, I think there was also, quite rightly, criticism of it being a kind of agent of gentrification, maybe focusing on more kind of official culture and presenting a kind of yuppified version of Glasgow. Sort of working class voices were left out. The grassroots were maybe left out. It was kind of a very top-down neoliberal version of culture. And I met there's a great book. It's just, it's all online. The Workers' City Collective put out a series of books, people like Jim Kelman writing for it and critiquing some of those aspects of the city culture.
That's it. It's very much about taking the elements that were palatable for tourists and selling, and also at the same time selling that back to Glaswegians as the culture that got supported, you know. At the time I didn't see any. It was interesting, you were saying that there were some positive things that came out of it, but at the time I didn't see anything positive from it at all. It felt really disempowering and really like monetizing folk culture, or the most palatable parts of folk culture being monetized and trying to convince Glaswegians that was their culture, you know?
Yeah, because I suppose you see a lot of the roots of what is now official Scottish culture kind of from that time, and the building of the concert hall and early Celtic connections, the big folk and roots festival that happens every year, has its kind of roots and stuff like that. And the jazz festival happened around the same time and so on. So there, yeah.
That's it. And Celtic Connections is really fascinating because Danny Kyle that started it was the dad of Janie Kyle, who was in Dawson and still is in some shapes and everything. They were good pals. And also Helen Kyle was one of the people who did the sit-in at Kenning Park. When that was closed down as a community centre, and then she was part of that sitting. But so what's really interesting, so just to say that they were, is a really interesting change from a militant culture and a very open-hearted folk culture, very down to earth, and that desire for folk culture to be supported and recognised, you know what I mean? Which is, you can see the drive for something like Celtic Connections to not have folk culture marginalised, but to have it kind of brought into the centre of the culture and validated. But then, of course, within a neoliberal setting, it gets validated in terms of a very particular set of criteria of basically of the spectacular, you know? And in the end... Yeah, that's a whole other podcast, isn't it? Like where folk music has got to, and how a kind of capitalist model has just foregrounded the spectacular and economic aspects of it, and backgrounded the militancy of it.
Junction!
worth talking a bit about the music of Dawson, because we've done a lot of the context and so on.
Aye.
But maybe just saying the sort of musical trajectory, starting off from some very stripped down guitars to using more electronic elements on the later records.
Yeah, I mean, actually, that's a great point. The big one actually is just listening back to the stuff, and the main thing is dub, is that we were so into dub, and there's these like really chaotic, like it's dense chaotic music, and then you're adding in like heaps of delays that are feeding back on themselves, and like test tones on the desk. With delays, and that was the thing that I was like dub was a really big influence, or was not a big influence. There was a lot of dub around, you know. That was a lot of the music we listened to when in our late teens, early 20s. I wasn't so much into the smoking and pills, but other folks were, and there was a lot of it around us, and reggae and dub was like, yeah, a really massive thing. And I'd kind of forgotten that. And to my surprise, I think they sound pretty good, those dubs. They sound pretty chaotic and almost a little bit, I mean, you know, shouldn't really put us in the same sentence, but it kind of reminds me a bit of the pop group or something like that. Like in terms of it being sort of being into being dance music, but being really hard as well. So yeah, I really enjoyed that. And then you're right, the second Dawson LP, there was elements of improv in it and sampling, and actually that's one thing that's really interesting is like I was saying earlier about the hip hop thing, there was a lot of really good British hip hop around that time, and the Music Collective even put on a couple of shows by a guy called Blade, and
a
band called Gunshot. Do you know Gunshot?
Yeah.
Our kind of hip hop collective. And so Music Collective put a gig on, and there's a group called Hijack, another London hip hop group that Dawson sampled basically on the second record. And really interestingly, sampling was pretty new. It was 91, new to us, maybe new. It wasn't new, but it was getting to the point where Akai samplers were in most studios. So, and the important thing to say about those first two Dawson records is that they were recorded at Tower Studios, and Richie was working at Tower Studios, and we would record them through the night on the downtime, basically, when the studio wasn't getting used. And Richie was engineering and playing. But yeah, and so there were samplers there. So we mess around with samplers, and Brycey and Angus came and did a sort of chanting and banging of metal percussion. So yeah, the second half of that second Dawson record just started to stretch out and be more improv-y and kind of making it in the studio rather than going in with songs, like I was saying, that you rehearsed that were super tight and then you went and did it. We made it a bit more. So, and the other interesting thing is kind of talking about context again, that's really interesting. Listen to that second Dawson record, the track that's got the hip hop sample in it also has a sample of Umu Sangare from Mali, which was another record that Gert put me onto. But it's just really interesting that we didn't think twice about legalities or any notions of appropriation. It was just, we just really thought it was a nice sound, and we just sampled it and slammed it across the whole track. And actually, and Lem Sissé, the Manchester poet, he sampled on it as well. But it was just interesting, you know, you cringe a bit listening back to it, because there just wasn't a dialogue about appropriation of other cultures then, and sampling, especially at that point, was just people grabbing what they wanted from where they wanted. So yeah, and then the third record, Richie left the band, and the third LP was Robbie McKendrick drumming on it, who's amazing, and was like someone else we grew up with. But it kind of went from that second LP started to be a bit more exploratory, and then it tightened up a bit, although we had Will Prentice, who played in Gila Monster, was playing Bulgarian bagpipes on it on that third Dawson record.
Radical Bagpipes. It's the same with our show.
tying it together. But so there's kind of less electronics on the third one.
Yeah.
But I think the little bits of kind of African guitar and stuff in the third one start to be a bit more prevalent. Mm-hmm. It's probably a little, like I say, there's a bunch of mid-90s bands that were in that were good bands. There's bands with Graham Gavin. I played in a band called Jay Mellis Hairweave Quartet. After the cheese shop. Because we were cheesy. Which had, which was Richie playing drums and Graham Gavin, who went on to be in Ganger. Who was in Lugworm and then went on to be in Ganger and then he's in the gymnastic band now. So Graham was in that with me and Richie, and it was in a band called Nostril, which was also Richie drumming, and Hubby R.M. Hubbard was playing bass on that band, and Simon Henderson, who went on to do most of the work with the Music Collective, was in that band afterwards. And a band called Brittle Hip, which was members of Stretchheads and Archbishop Kebab, who we didn't talk about yet, from Edinburgh.
We played them on the first show. They're great.
Aye, totally. So Neil from Archbishop Kebab was, and Angela playing sax from Archbishop Kebab, she was in Brittle Hip, and Tony Kennedy from Badgewater, who we haven't talked much about either. And Badgewater, I put out the first couple of records by Badgewater on Gruffwood, and then they did a bunch of records with Guided Missile, actually, down in London. But also, they did a lot of music, different folks as well. So that was, kind of mid-90s. And then I moved, it's not really important where I moved to, but I moved down to Brighton for a bit. And that's when I started to get more into improv stuff. I played with a really fun, amazing guy called Ian Paxson, who does a thing called Hamilton Yarns, which is it's great. It's kind of, it's almost like some kind of sort of chamber storytelling group or something. Really, pretty unique, I think. It's really great. And he's a very un-rock drummer. Just very playful. Amazing musician. So I start to do quite a lot of improv with him, basically. Excuse me. And with a cello player called Bella Emerson. And so in Brighton, that's when I started to actually do that a bit more regularly. I mean, I don't think it was that good, but it was still one of those things that, after seeing The X and all that, like 10 years earlier, doing that stuff took me about that long to find people to play with, or maybe find the guts to have a go at it. And around that time in Brighton, actually, I started playing with my amazing chosen family sister, as we call each other, Lisa Fannin. And we started a band, actually, with a drummer from New York who is a really good pal, called Dave Powell. And that was called Clack. And we started, and Dave came to Brighton and we played. And then then we went to America and did some gigs with Clack, and Lisa was playing viola and doing spoken word stuff. And actually another band around that time was Runt, which was with Wilf, who's the drummer from Dogface Hermans, and Craig Flanagan, who's the guitar player from God's My Co-Pilot. And then laterally, a guy called Dave Campbell, who played in a band called I'm Being Good, who are a really brilliant noise rock band from Brighton. So it was Wilf and then me and Craig, and then Wilf and me and Dave. So that did quite a lot. Runt played in Belgium and Holland and stuff, and moved there. Never did any records. We've done a bunch of recording, but never did any records yet. I'm still planning on sifting through this old DAT tapes. So I guess, for me, musically, I think Clack was the most important thing. That me and Lisa started doing stuff, and we still do stuff as a duo now without Dave, called Clacker, which is Lisa Fannin's words and me improvising. And Lisa also does some loops of words. And definitely a song I'd like to play is actually from Lisa, did a book of poetry called Fault Line, and then did a lot of got a lot of guests to work with her. Lots of amazing people. So yeah, so the one there, play the one called Nuclear that also has Alison Rowe on it.
Hiroshima, Nagasaki, if we all wear velvet gloves, can we put you back? Black box, lower you down, chant, arrow tip, never to target, no target to find. Mankind marching on gravel, hands up in the air, fade out, the sound of crystal clear running water. It's too late. Wait. Someone said something about an ice wall. 1.4 kilometres of coolant to freeze the groundwater around the spill, leaching from 1,000 hastily constructed tanks. 355,000 tonnes of radioactive water, 400 more washing out every day. A lead cover falls, a candle blows out. It's cold, it's frantic. There were news flashes, then no more news flashes, then it was quiet. Just the constant, slow leak of cesium hotspots for all the steel walls they had raised in the seabed around the crippled plant, collapsed at the edge of the ocean, clutching at its sides, the hot, hot water pouring through its fingers. On the ocean floor, fissures where tectonic plates are slowly yawning apart, or around volcanic activity, hydrothermal vents, extreme heat. The water, far past boiling, fathoms down, molten ore seeps, making black smoky chimneys in the pitch darkness, the midnight zone. Such force as quake from here that pushed a tsunami to the shore. Silence. Doors fallen from frames. Dry brushweed in cracks. A small breeze through abandoned buildings. One woman still goes back in to feed the cats. Derelict roadblocks, shop shelves hanging empty, children's toys tipped on their sides, rusting bikes, rusting cars, the Geiger counter clicking high in the grasses. One sievert dose, radiation sickness, nausea. 5 sieverts, kill you within a month. 10 sieverts, dead in weeks. The 73 sievert-tolerant robots they sent into Fukushima just faltering malfunction. Hot concrete, hot metal, hot air. Recent reactor levels there, reading 530 sieverts per hour. Look away, history cowers, guilt, who, gap, when. Shows us tight jaw lines, jaws clenching. Now no one's saying anything, anything at all. My mother tells me my uncle had said, er blieb dann manchmal die Nacht. He used to pass through in the 1970s. Nuclear scientist. They invited him on the way out to Japan. Das hatte er damals schon gesagt. That they shouldn't build it there. On a fault line. Back. Black box. Lower you down. Chant, mankind, hands up, fade out, the sound of crystal clear running water. Back, black box, lower you down, chant, mankind, hands up, fade out, the sound of crystal clear running water. Back, black box, lower you down, chant, mankind, hands up, fade out, the sound of crystal clear running water. Back, black box, lower you down, chant, mankind, hands up, fade out, the sound of crystal clear running water.
Coming back to Glasgow and started playing with Shane Connolly. We started doing improv duos, actually. And I remember Nuts and Seeds put us on, and I think Cry Parrot put us on. But Cry Parrot, that basically became Sycamore eventually with Stevie Jones. So Shane, me, and Stevie Jones started playing as Sycamore, because it was a trio, and we played a bunch of gigs and we did these recordings, but they didn't feel like there were enough, just the three of us. So then Stevie Jones took it off and did all the other arranging on it. So that Rafe wasn't on that one actually, but Georgie McGoon or White was on that. Nerea Bello was on that, which actually is the one I'd like to play. It's a song called New Cold that's got Nerea on it, and Daniel Padden's playing bass clarinet on it. And Georgie's on that. Connolly with taiko drums, and Alison Rowe, who's on the Lisa Fannin track, and that band eventually got called Isho, which had Georgie McGoon and Alison Rowe and Shane and me and Lucy Searle. And that was fun. Isho played. I remember we played one of the early gigs. we played, was it the Captain's Rest? Eva Ganatiuk did a fundraiser night, and Kylie Minogue played and famously smashed his head open on the low ceiling.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
and like, literally put the lights out, and he had those things on his hands that generated sound somehow, that he had sort of lights on them. And the lights went out.
Some kind of LED thing, yeah.
Yeah, but they were really strong lights, and the lights in the room went out, and he just jumped off a table to start his set and basically whacked his head on a on a beam or something. Do you know what I mean? But
it was a small space.
Yeah. No, it was. I was proper. Like, yeah, he needs an ambulance. I think he was fine. Oof. But Isho played that, and it was really fun to play big taiko drums in a mm-hmm. context. Play with taiko drums, which has been amazing. After Isho, then ended up starting doing other stuff with taiko, with Painted X-Ray, which we still play a lot mm-hmm. with. And so I've been playing with taiko drums for about 12 years or something like that. And it's a really singular thing to play to. But anyway, just to say that those original gigs, yeah, they were just like on noisy bills, and to take taiko, mm-hmm. taiko drums into mm-hmm. those wee spaces with like, you know, drums that fill every sort mm-hmm. of crevice of the room with sound was it was really fun. And that's also when I first started getting into doing stuff with dance. I wrote a thing called From Home, which was a four guitars thing. And ended up playing it live with Hubby, RM Hubbard, Stevie Jones, and Robert, actually, from Robert Johnson from Life Without Buildings. Mm-hmm. Robert Dallas Gray, as he is now. So that was the first time I think I'd ever written all the parts for other people to play, and it's not super complicated. It's not like Sound of Yell standard, but it was the first time I'd ever spent like 6 weeks kind of doing a composing thing. And that ended up being a dance piece with an amazing dancer from London called Annie Locke. And that was the first, and that was another thing, like the improv in Brighton. That was, yeah, another thing that I'd really wanted to get into doing stuff with dance for a really long time. And and just hadn't met people. And then I met Annie through Ian Paxson that I was talking about, actually. And had a really amazing experience working with her. And then also, so that's the next big thing that happens. Who cares about my life, for fuck's sake? This is tedious.
No.
The next big thing that happened was Luke Sutherland, who I didn't talk about previously, who was in Longfin Killy.
Yeah.
Who were another amazing band that were around Glasgow in the early 90s. Really unique band, from Perthshire originally. Again, merging like various kinds of indie guitar music with like bouzoukis and folk stuff. Luke's amazing voice. So they were a really inspirational band, and Dawson played quite a lot with them, actually. So anyway, me and Luke had seen each other very infrequently, and I think 2008 or 9, Luke had been asked to work on a dance project with Christine Devaney, a dancer in Edinburgh, and he was asked to bring another musician into the process. So he asked me, and that was incredible. And Christine's a sort of incredible hub for the dance world in Scotland. If a person can be a hub, can a person be a hub? She's an amazing sort of facilitator of and the dance community in Scotland is amazing anyway. It's really supported. It's really supportive. I mean, it's really supportive. It's really no bullshit. It's small enough that when you meet somebody, you can quite quickly meet a lot of other people. And that's what happened to me. I was really lucky that I was working with Christine, and Christine knew a lot of other dancers. So I met a lot of other dancers and started working with them, brilliant dancer called Rosalind Masson, and that was the first time actually. That was the first time ever that I got a little bit of money from Creative Scotland to do the From Home dance piece. But that was the first time that I had, like, I guess 6 weeks to make the show or 8 weeks to make the show with Christine Devaney and a guy called Michael Sharon and Luke Sutherland, where I was paid like for like 8 weeks work, which, you know, at that point I was like, what age was I? Like nearly 40. Do you know what I mean? And that was the first time I'd had sort of a sustained paid gig. It makes me think actually that another thing that happened around that time is that Ajay, that was in Donkey, had another band called The Bent Moustache, and with their regular guitar player who plays in De Kift, a guy called Pim, who plays in that amazing band De Kift from the Netherlands. Pim couldn't do this tour, so Ajay asked me to come and do this 10-week tour of America, and I think it was 2007, supporting Sebado, going all around America for 10 weeks, which was, just an unbelievable experience. So I suppose that in tandem with the Chris Devaney was the first time I could actually start to get some money and or be a bit supported by doing music. So the thing with Luke, it was incredible to play with Luke and the whole process of playing with the dancers and, like I said, meeting lots of other dancers was amazing. And quite early on in the first, I think it was the first or second week. No, it was the first week. It was like the third or fourth day, me and Luke had this idea to not stop playing all day. So it was like an eight hour dance residency that we were working on ideas, but me and Luke would never stop playing. So even if we were talking through ideas, we would just turn our volume down, but keep playing. And from that, me and Luke started to do things called long players, where we would play for 8 hours, sometimes 9 hours nonstop. But the idea was not that it was a jam, that it was, the idea was always that if somebody came and saw half an hour of it, that they'd feel that they'd seen something that was kind of substantial, and feel like they'd seen a gig. But we tended to do it as open sessions for dancers as well. But we did one in Copenhagen, we did one in Barcelona, we did a couple in Edinburgh. But that was also just like at the same time as all this world was opening up around dance and the possibility of sound interacting with dance, which is, yeah, there's so much to say about that. I was also just doing those long players with Luke and really just diving in to the experience of it. And of course they were improvising as well. So it was like, it's like 8 or 9 hour improvised gigs. Sometimes with a loop going, do you know what I mean? So you can have a wee cup of tea.
Yeah. Yeah. So with the dance, I'm interested in, I suppose it depends on the project, but to what extent is it composed or improvised? Who kind of instigates? Or maybe these questions are kind of, again, it can be all of that, perhaps.
Yeah,
and just depending on the moment, on the situation.
Depends on the project. So, for instance, so around this time, really importantly, we can come back to Winter Cycle in a second. But in 2010, when I was working with Chris Devaney and Luke and Michael, I met dancer Selene Weinachter, and we started working together under the banner of Collective Endeavours. And the first show we did was totally composed, actually. It was a duet, but it was totally composed. It's called Cairngorm Snow. It's about climate change. And we took that to Italy and did it in Scotland. But that was totally composed, and then Selene and myself, because we'd improvised a lot before we composed, we decided to try and do a larger improvised group. Actually, no, we didn't. We did a duo show with improvising first called around titles, which was just picking titles up from out from a hat. And the big impetus was that was how do you build a relationship with sort of really direct political ideas through in dance and music. And improvised dance and music. What's the place and relationship of ideas and politics? So that was like a structured improv where we would pick out titles and that would shape the improv. And then from that we wanted to do a bigger group of improvisers, music and dance. And we worked with Luke again in that, and Alex South joined us, the brilliant clarinet player, and then a bunch of dancers: Joanne Clavili, Nerea Gudachaga. I'm going to forget some names, which is terrible, isn't it? I should have written them all down. But anyway, so just to say that's where me and Celine, that's where the work really started on really getting into the mechanics of improvising with music mm-hmm. and dance. And so our whole approach to it was that we felt that quite often improvised music and dance, when I saw stuff, I became quite evangelical about dance. Like, I totally love it. And I think it's really important. I think in this culture that's like so terrified of the body, that's so much in the head, I think it's really important, and I became quite evangelical about it, and I really wanted people to see dance who didn't normally see dance, and I really was enjoying improvising, so I wanted people to, and I was hoping that people would want to come and see, some people who didn't think dance was for them would come and see something that was not spectacular, that was in, you know, I mean, Celine did things in art galleries and in music festivals and town squares, and, you know what I mean, trying to take, I mean, I'm not saying nobody else does that, you know what I mean, a lot of people take dance to all kinds of places, but in terms of trying to get people who don't think they're into dance to see it, it's you have to take it out of the theatre, I think. me and Celine saw a lot of dance that, and improvised music and dance that we thought was quite impenetrable for somebody who hasn't seen dance. And so then we started to build a methodology about how do we give shape to the improv, because it's so much information. Music and dance is just like a massive amount of information to take in, especially if you're not used to dance, and people feel so much like, oh, I don't understand this. And so you need to make space for people to feel unsure about it. And I think a good way to do that is to give the thing a really nice form, to give it a really tight form, which allows people to, in terms of music and dance, people will start to form narratives, even just the number of people who are interacting on stage, you know what I mean? People will start to form narratives or ideas of narratives or you know, snapshots. So then we really start to get into the mechanics of it. We start to get into the mechanics of group decision-making, of notions of structure or form. All these words are really tricky. A lot of people understandably can get put off by any of these words, I think, like structure or form or framework. When you're improvising, some people don't like that use of those terms at all, but it's just the shape of the thing. It's just to give the thing shape, which is not... is of course not the tradition in free improvising. A lot, you know, free improvising is, in musical terms, is just wide open, and the structure will just unfold from the material. But we thought music and dance improvisation needed a different approach because for two reasons: there's a lot of information, and there's a lot of people who don't understand or feel they don't understand the dance. Through using mostly really simple tasks, just started to really break down the mechanics of working as a group and then focusing on individuals' decision-making at different times. You know, really zooming into the moment of when you're making a decision and sort of zooming in any closer so that you can start to break down your process of decision-making in the moment. We which of course is just something that's is ongoing through time. You're just you're making decisions, you're computating and making decisions in real time. Excuse me. And so to answer your question about who instigates what in the music and dance improv that we do as collective endeavors, it's just, it's based on these tasks and it's based on really clear decision-making that has a knock-on effect of clear decision-making, which creates a form that it's not that everybody can necessarily agree on where they're at in the form of the improv, but sometimes it really feels like the sort of path of the improv is like we're generating it and it's generating it itself, you know, or this thing we're sitting in it, even though we're creating it.
So
I still do stuff with dance that's really totally composed. But Collective Endeavors was, it's also really, that's really informed how I think about improv generally. And Winter Cycle was 2010, December 2010 to the start of January 2011. It came from a few things. It came from really despising how midwinter feels in capitalism, and wanting to find some other way to mark midwinter that wasn't just people buying shite and feeling down if they don't feel like they have the people around them they want to Christmas, or feeling isolated, or all that brutal stuff that happens to people around midwinter. And so I can't remember the exact, I think it was something like I wanted to have Winter Solstice be the middle of the winter cycle, and I think in that year I think it happened to be that it was like full moon or something like that on winter solstice, and somehow that just seemed like a nice cycle to do. So I did the moon cycle. I think that's what it was. I think I did the 28 days of the moon cycle. I don't think I did the 31 days of a month. I think I can't quite remember. Or maybe I did do a full month. Anyway, the full moon was on the solstice, and that gave the shape of what I wanted to do. And I did a different duo every day for those, I think it was 31 days, 30 or 31 days. And yeah, I suppose it was that thing of, I'd been back in Glasgow for about 5 years by that point, and already in that 5 years, I'd sort of reconnected to old friends and made new friends, enough people that I could do like 31 duos in a row. It just seemed to illustrate that thing of how incredible the scene is in Glasgow, you know. And I don't know about you, but it's a lot of talk about, you know, there's a lot of conversation about notions of what home is, but Glasgow kind of